Had a very, very good panel so far, and now we have a debate. I would like to ask several things, because this event is being recorded, that when it gets time for the questions, you step up to the microphones and don't yell out anything. Say it all into the mics. Identify yourself and your affiliation. We have a format to this debate. Pulling this thing together, I feel very, very fortunate and very grateful to Scott Charney and Dan Geer for agreeing to do this and coming out here. I think it's the coup of the century to pull this thing off, and the century is pretty young, so I can have a coup of the century. We'll have a few more. The ground rules are, and setting this up with a lot of email running back and forth, I think I know how campaign managers feel when they're setting up the presidential debates, but we did arrive at consensus, and I think we're going to have a lively and healthy discussion. I would like to ask, because of the particular polarization that I suspect from this audience, that you be respectful of all opinions, that we act all professionally and listen to each other and you know, take it seriously. The format will be that Dan Geer will open up with a maximum 20-minute statement, then Scott Charney will speak for a maximum of 20 minutes. Then we will open up the floor to questions. Each question, both of the debaters will have the opportunity to answer it in turn, and then we'll move on to the next one. When there are approximately 10 minutes left, I will cut off the questions, and then Scott will have a closing statement, and then Dan will have a closing statement. One little experiment that we want to do is I'm going to ask Dan and Scott to each, before we actually get started, to give a one or two sentence position statement of what it is that they're debating and what their position is. And we're going to ask for a show of hands to see which person you particularly agree with. If you don't agree with either of them, you don't have to raise your hand. If you agree with both, you can raise your hand both times. Hopefully most of you will only raise your hand once. And at the very end of this debate, we're going to do the same thing, see if we've accomplished anything. Okay, so without further ado, I would like to ask Dan to give his statement and Scott to give his.
It's actually fairly simple, and it's as it was last September. It's simply that when a prey species is all alike, the predators have an easier go of it, and that is true in computing as it is in nature.
And my view is that forcing diversity in the way that is suggested actually won't solve our problem.
Okay, by show of hands, this side. By show of hands, this side. Okay. I would let each of the debaters, Dan and Scott, give a brief introduction of who they are, and then they can go into their statements. So the introduction does not count towards your time. But if it's very long, I'll cut you off.
No, that would be Jack Valenti, who does long introductions. Okay, I'm no stranger here. I've been around the computing world for a long time.
Could we please get some more volume on...
Let's try that again. I'll speak... Is this... If I swallow the mic, is that better? Okay. That makes it hard to look down, which I'm going to have to do in a moment. I've been around the computing world for quite a while. I've been in security by accident, as everyone who is. The history part of it, I guess, that matters is between Project Athena and Kerberos, a variety of gigs in New York and Washington, numbers of startups, which is to say I'm on startup number 6, so I must not be quite getting this right yet, and a long history with Usenix, for which I have an enormous affection, including being the president here for a short period of time. Okay, we're going to go this way then. All right, fine. I will endeavor to speak loud enough that I can actually read what I need to read as well. I'd like to get right to it. The question in front of us is, an operating system monoculture a threat to security? A computing monoculture is a danger, a security danger, a national security danger. It is a danger on principle. It is a danger in practice. It is at the same time avoidable and mitigable. But it is neither cheap nor easy to do so if you have to start from where we are today. I have but minutes to be clear, so I invoke Alexander Pope. Men must be taught as if you taught them not, and things unlearned proposed as things forgot, which is to say, I must make analogy between things you already know and things you didn't know that you already knew. My opponent will do the same. He's a lawyer, and the practice of law is a search for analogies, just as I am doing here. Computing systems in the large trend toward the same phenomenologic rule space as biologic systems in the large. We recognize this in our language, the very word virus, for example. We recognize it in our strategies. The application firewall is a semi-permeable membrane. We recognize it in our command structures. For example, the idea that some content is toxic and must be subject to filtration. The more we know about the natural world, the more impressive it is. The natural world is the sum of the planet's history. When you talk to a geneticist, when you talk to a bacteriologist, what they will tell you is that when they read the genome of this or that species, what they read is an historical document. The genome tells you what you have, but more importantly, it tells you how you got there. It tells you strategies proven correct in the crucible of competition. You discover that gene encoding is not efficient because molecules are cheap while editing is expensive. Just as in our world of computing, it is cheaper to keep everything than to do selective data deletion. The whole of an organism's history is there, and which is more, that history is compressed. And I don't need to remind any of you how hard it is to compress time. By a different analogy to our world, backward compatibility is how we drag history along with us, and it shows. It is said that 80% of the labor cost of deploying a new version of Windows is in ensuring backward compatibility. There is an infrastructure in biology, just like there is in the doubtless primitive computing of mid-2004. For example, the basic metabolism of the citric acid cycle is common to all life as we know it. This leads to a deep question. Is that cycle the only one that works? Is it so cumbersome to invent such a cycle that evolution will produce at most one within the habitability lifetime of the planet? Or are there several, all of which have been tried and found wanting, save the one we have now? That cycle is encoded in what is called the minimum gene set, the essential instructions that get an infrastructure to run. Those genes are the most protected we have. I won't analogize computing truths from that except to say that working infrastructures are likely to be boiled down to their essence. They will have no unneeded interconnections, and nothing about their replication will be sloppy, nor will their defense. No life competes at this level. The bacteriologist Trudy Wassenaar shared with me a number of truths. First, immunity is expensive. The greater the fraction of an organism's function is given over to self-protection from contagion, the more that organism will have to find other survival strategy to pay for that immunity. At the same time, the more advanced the organism, the more it needs immunity both to survive and to replicate, because the bigger or longer lived it is, the more it is a target for the evolutionary survival of its enemies. The analogy with computing is clear. The bigger and juicier you are, the more predators you attract. Unless, of course, you live on an island where its size, not immunity, matters. Note well, the overarching purpose of any immune response is to localize infection. This is even more important when similarly disposed individuals live in close quarters, where transmission of pathogens is prompt and casual. The location-free characteristic of the internet makes casual transmission of pathogens the norm, as you are in close contact with every other species and organism. Thus, as we stand here today, and as a matter of immune response in the large, it is far more important for the enterprise's security to focus on egress filtering than it is on ingress. At the same time, immunity has risks of its own. Autoimmune diseases are a danger to anyone with an immune system. The rise in the incidence in rich countries of diseases such as asthma is widely viewed to be correlated with the antiseptic lifestyle that interferes with what is called priming, that is, early childhood's training of the immune system through exposure to both self and not self. By analogy, the avalanche of spam overwhelms our computing systems with rising false positive rates that deny transit to legitimate email. As recent proposals from my opponent's firm amply demonstrate, spam is now engendering a significant autoimmune pathology. Spam will extinct anonymous speech on the internet far more effectively than any government diktat ever could. In the world of infectious diseases, virulence is appreciated not so much as a measure of danger to the host, but as a calibration, an adaptive reaction on the part of the infecting organism. If your body has strong immune reaction to a given pathogen, then to survive, that pathogen must make you cough or sneeze or run, as it must get to another host before it dies in you. The analogy with our world is clear. The slammer is a nuisance because it spreads quickly, thus to evade our immune response. But what we have more to fear is the slow scan infection that can afford to be symptomless because it is unmolested by our immune system. Some pathogens are opportunistic. Pneumonias often appear in those in already immunocompromised states, pneumocystis being the one you most likely have heard of. Ever since NIMDA, Viri have multiple transmission vectors and always include the back door of entry points of other worms and viri then in circulation. With the witty worm, we even have a direct attack on the immune system of a creative and self-selected subset of the user community, which needs no explanation as to analogy. Though it is not an issue here, the spread of certain kinds of infection inside Microsoft itself is nothing so much as the analogic equivalent of the rapid spread of nosocomial infection in a hospital setting. And as with a hospital, lockdown quarantine for a time is the only real countermeasure. In the world of epidemiology, which is the study of the spread of disease, there are concepts that so clearly apply to us in our world that they need enumeration rather than explanation. The first of these is summed up in the term herd immunity, which is simply that if the herd is immune above some threshold percentage, then no member of the herd is at risk, though even though susceptible individuals remain. Public health practitioners endeavor to determine a number, the epidemic prevention potential, against which they grade vaccination programs. We have direct examples of this. Qualys on the West Coast does scanning. Their findings are intriguing. Patching, our analogy to immunization, follows a half-life decay curve, which is to say that for each succeeding half-life interval, half of the then unpatched systems will be patched. A half-life curve means that for constant effort, you never finish. At the same time, it is widely documented that the interval between the announcement of a patch or a vulnerability and the appearance of an exploit in the wild is shrinking. Consequently, and just as in public health calculations, the national policy question is whether you can get enough reasonably effective influenza vaccine into enough people between your first warning and the next novel strain. As children have fewer rights and share more fluids, we simply mandate their immunization. An analogy at the level of the internet and national infrastructure is dauntingly obvious. Should ISPs, the analog of public schools, be required to demand proof of immunization before permitting client entry into their networks? Were one to set out to design a worst-case disease, it would have these characteristics: 100% effective transmission, zero delay between infection and infectiousness, long-delayed symptoms, and no acquired immunity. This describes to a fault a polymorphic virus working amongst a monoculture of hosts exhibiting the same vulnerability. Were one to introduce a new predator, the prey who had never before seen it are ripe for slaughter, whether we are talking about rabbits harvesting Australian grasslands or the African clawed frog harvesting the ponds of Golden Gate Park. It is the predators that force prey species to diversify. This description is to a fault what any computing systems planner must do today if he or she is to meet a reliability metric. Thus, our machine rooms are more diverse than our desktops, a testimony to this fact. Prior to today and other venues, my opponent has practiced a counterclaim that I am talking about mutation in the world of chemistry and physics, but that there is a qualitative break between the organic processes of evolution and the world of computers. His main point is that of distinguishing the sentient opponent, such as the average virus writer, from randomly rebonding amino acid helixes. He argues that flesh and spirit are not the same. While I agree with him that the soul is as real as the sun, he misses the point. Biologic mutation is not random, despite the popular sense that it is. What we see in computer viruses is non-random mutation called directed mutation, based on an intention of success. Selection based on intention is like any other selection and yields the same outcome. Questions of intentionality versus random mutation are ill-conceived. It is true that biologic mutation can be detached from selection, whereas this does not seem to be so in computer virus mutation. That is to say, computer virus mutation is strongly connected to selection. But when looking at evolution, it does not matter what the selection process is, only that there is one. The net effect of a sentient opponent is thus merely to compress time, which is to say, to accelerate the accumulation of selected mutations in the genome. As such, the lessons of biology are perhaps more dear than we realize. To take the example of mutation closest to you here today, E. coli has a dual function in your gut, digestion, of course, but also occupying a niche that if it didn't occupy, something worse would. As such, it is in your interest that E. coli not die out, even if you take erythromycin or eat something really bizarre. As it happens, E. coli mutates at a high rate. Perhaps 1% of the total cellular load you carry are mutant. This is diversity at the individual cell level. It is unlikely that any one insult to your gut would kill all of them, and the ones that survived would repopulate, as replication is something they do very well, if sloppily. You do not have, in other words, a monoculture, despite what you may have thought, even as a single-celled animal can afford to be one. For E. coli, diversity is a strategic defense against unanticipatable threats, and it has millions of years of success to show for it. Looking at nature more broadly, ecosystems that persist accumulate diversity over time. It doesn't start out that way. Diversity is a result of selection pressure and survival advantage rather than a precondition to it. That doesn't mean that one or another species isn't statistically superabundant like wildebeest in Serengeti. Diversity tends to arrive in bursts, and often after cataclysms of one sort or another that remove keystone species or entire niches, what Stephen Jay Gould so eloquently called punctuated equilibria. Ecologists and evolutionary biologists the world over agree an ecosystem that is low on diversity is unhealthy. An ecosystem that is losing diversity is one that is on a trajectory to collapse, a collapse that accelerates as the end grows near and the efficiency of predation is abetted by the loss of prey diversity. Microsoft has had some verbal support from friends such as Marcus Ranum, who argues that there's no monoculture because his Windows box is festooned with gadgets, that gluing on feature after feature and attaching more and more USB cables creates diversity on the ground. Were that true, one should expect that security could be added on as an afterthought, that one could actually patch oneself to safety. As nearly every pro-monoculture writer quotes Ranum, let me do the same, he writes, "There is no monoculture here. My system isn't just Windows. My security is affected by a bewildering combination of default settings, software patch levels, default firewall rules, browser settings, and antivirus signature sets. We're not in anything like danger of becoming a monoculture unless every system was running the same software loadout, security policy, antivirus product, and patch level. In spite of the dearest wishes of countless system administrators, that simply isn't going to happen." I need not point out that I'm speaking today to countless system administrators, and I dare say it is flatly not their dearest wish to have that sort of monoculture that Ranum understands. No, Ranum confuses himself and gullible others by envisioning monoculture as if cloning. Perhaps the Borg did get to him after all, but it did not get to me, and I don't want it to get to you. A monoculture does not imply identicality. It implies going above a critical threshold of common vulnerability, a threshold you may recognize only after you have crossed it. Another prevalent confusion, which in the spirit of charity I will call confusion rather than apologia, is that a protocol can be a monoculture. If you believe that, then you get to call TCP a monoculture. And then to argue with me that if monocultures are bad, then TCP must be bad, and if TCP is bad, why is anything still standing? To accept that argument is to throw the core principles of software engineering out the door. What has always worked and what will always work is to have loosely coupled modules communicating well over well-defined interfaces. Of course there can be flaws in protocols. Last year's attack on SNMP hosts are just such an example. That might even be a monoculture problem, but it isn't SNMP. It is the mind-numbing complexity of ASN1 specification leading to the absurd level of effort to write an ASN1 compiler and the resulting reliance of virtually the entire world on, you guessed it, one ASN1 compiler, one code base. Those arguing that protocols are monocultures would be wise to understand the root causality of their arguments. It is a core principle of science to seek the simplest explanation of observed facts. The entire purpose of a null hypothesis is to first assert such an hypothesis, and then, if you can, to disprove it, thereby establishing that the world cannot be as simple as thought. Our null hypothesis today is that lessons learned in that natural world apply to us in the computing world. Perhaps it can be proved that they do not, but it will require proof, and the burden of that proof is on those who would argue that life does not hold lessons for us, that somehow we've invented something that does not follow the same rules as everything else in the creation. That is a tall order and an understatement. And so we come to the national security at today's resolve. Is an operating system monoculture a threat to national security? Unless and until the argument can be made that the lessons of nature do not hold, the answer is a flat yes. In the monoculture in which we find ourselves today, the skill-to-power ratio of the user community is falling fast. They do not get twice as smart every 18 months. Amongst the periphery of the internet, which is where the numeric growth is and where the monoculture is most in evidence, to be secure takes all the running you can do to keep in the same place. A monoculture of ready prey lessens the skill level needed by predators, and as we stand here, it is likely that the worldwide number of virus writers exceeds the corresponding number of antivirus researchers. This enormous pool of potential attackers creates a pall of smoke over the internet, like a forest fire upwind. That smoke screen can be felt in many ways. John Quarterman estimates that 10% of total internet backbone traffic is low-level scans. Honeypots record hits within minutes of their appearance on a routable address. Lawrence Berkeley Labs estimates that 40% of their inbound connections are attacks. These are symptoms of circling predators who need only know one target well, as the environment is target-rich. Were the environment to become significantly more diverse, the skill level of attackers would have to be far higher than it is today, were they then to retain their present level of access. But in the spirit of calculus, which is the infinite sum of infinitesimals, the sum of amateur attacks is a smokescreen in a different sense. That swirl of smoke is more than sufficient to provide a hiding place for those attackers who are threats at a different level. Their scans appear just one more example of scans. The hosts they own appear just one more example of remote exploitation. No, the real issue of the monoculture is more profound. The most advanced societies are those that are most interdependent. We are the most advanced, and we are the most interdependent society the world has. We are ipso facto the most vulnerable to disruption amongst and between our interdependencies. If you are a vulnerability researcher, you take the conservative assumption that when you discover a vulnerability, you're not first to do so. The observant among you will have long since noted that all the global scale virus events to date have exploited vulnerabilities that were already publicly known. Where then are the vulnerabilities that are not publicly known? If not publicly known, they are not publicly patched. It is the unknown vulnerabilities against which we bet when we choose monocultures. The breadth of vulnerability is always maximal for the unknown vulns. The leak of some of the Windows 2K source pool this past February resulted within a week of the discovery of vulnerabilities. Perhaps it was rediscovery, but that would be consistent with the unknown vulnerabilities point in that it is only the public disclosure and repair of a vulnerability that stops the clock. It is if those vulns and others can be found by examining the source, then multiple national laboratories have long since found those and others. Though unrelated to Windows, the witty worm is instructive. It appeared less than 48 hours after the vulnerability was disclosed, and the quality of the code was almost certainly too good to have been done from a standing start. As such, it appears that this vuln was known to somebody, and that somebody had at his disposal a botnet as over 100 simultaneous ignition points heralded its arrival. The better virus writers know always to leave a backdoor. For those pros, the measure of their success is the reduction in the energy cost of penetration between the first visit and the second. And a new backdoor gives maximum reduction in that cost of a second visit. A multi-vector virus sweeping through has the effect of creating a monoculture, of creating a suite of machines who are more alike than they were before, because while each may have had one of the 10 vulnerabilities this particular virus could exploit, after it passes through, they all have the same vulnerability, the new backdoor. In other words, the predators have as their prime strategy to make the prey all look alike. Monoculture is again the issue. My opponent will no doubt soon invoke economics by saying that diversity may be good for security, but it isn't cheap. I could hardly agree more. As with biology, if you think security is expensive, try insecurity. He will say that the buying public drives what his company produces and that to expect anything else is ludicrous. I could not agree more. The public wants quality to be free and always has. But I will say what I said last September and reaffirm tonight. All monocultures live on borrowed time. In their golden age, they are a pleasure to take up, but afterwards they are a millstone about the neck. Just as the Irish people relied on potatoes and got famine, just as the southern farmers relied on cotton and got the boll weevil, just as Brazilian cocoa farmers are looking at disaster as we sit here today, so too are we. We farm data and electrons. Are we so vain as to imagine that we are not subject to the laws of nature and of nature's God?
Okay, thank you very much, Dan. Scott will now introduce himself, and then he'll give his statement.
Unlike Dan, I'm probably not as familiar to some of you, so I'm going to spend just a little more time explaining my background, in part because it shapes the way I think about this problem. For starters, I'm an English and history major, very helpful. I went to law school. I was an assistant district attorney in Bronx County for 7 years, prosecuting street crimes. And then after 7 years in the Bronx DA's office, I got a call from a former Bronx assistant named Barbara Brennan asking me if I wanted to join the federal government, the organized crime and racketeering section. I was in the South Bronx, and I was deputy chief of the Arson Bureau. And as I looked out over the South Bronx, it sounded to me like going to the feds might be a good idea. So I said to her, sure, I'm interested. And she said, well, it's not here in our San Francisco office. It's in our field office. And I said, where's the field office? She said, Honolulu, Hawaii. So I called my wife to tell her about the offer. By the time I got home, the house was packed. I went out to Hawaii for 3 years, and then I moved to Maine Justice to the General Litigation and Legal Advice section, which, as its name suggests, we did general litigation and gave legal advice to the government. At the time, we had a proprietary operating system called Eagle with a nice American flag and a bald eagle. And they had a bunch of menu options, E, email, D, go to DOS. So I hit D, go to DOS to create some subdirectories. This is November of 1990. My boss, Jim Reynolds, walks in. He hasn't seen a greater than sign since fourth grade. He says, what are you doing? I said, well, I have a home PC. I'm creating some subdirectories in DOS. And he said, please don't break anything. 3 months later, Bob Mueller, the assistant attorney general for the criminal division, now the FBI director, said he wanted to do something significant with cybercrime. Cybercrimes was in the fraud section, and they had one lawyer doing cybercrimes. The fraud section had over 100 lawyers, but most of them were dedicated to healthcare fraud and defense procurement fraud, you know, the $400 toilet seats. And so Bob Mueller decided if cybercrimes was going to get the attention it deserves, He needed to move it out of that section. And he looked at the general litigation and legal advice section, which had no major programs. So he called up Jim Reynolds, my boss, and he says, I want to give you cyber crimes. Can you handle it? And Jim said, of course I can. I have a computer expert. And for the next 8.5 years, I was responsible and the lead federal prosecutor for cyber crimes in the United States. I actually did have a history with computers. My father was an MIT grad. After fighting in World War II, he taught me to program a little bit in COBOL when I was 8. I did punch cards and all that stuff, but I am not a computer person. And I, you know, read Dan's paper, and I actually think, of course, that diversity is a factor in security. It can be relevant, certainly can. My concern is about the oversimplification of the argument. If homogeneity is a bad idea and dangerous, I don't think we can as loosely dismiss the protocol and API problems, nor can we dismiss other products in the marketplace. For example, it's estimated that Cisco has 86.5% of the router market and 60% of the core internet routers. So if homogeneity is per se bad, we need to think about where we diversify and how we diversify everything. In fact, one of the examples Dan just used was spam. I'm not sure how diversity is going to solve the spam problem, particularly if you want mail to be able to send from anyone to anyone on any device at any time. But the fact of the matter is that forcing diversity at a 50% level, as proposed by Dan, will not solve the problem. The real issues are, why do bad guys attack systems, and in what ways can we protect them? So, for example, although you can say there's a monoculture of Windows, at the same time, not all Windows boxes and environments are alike. Actually, Marcus Rainham is right on this point. If you look at things like Sasser that affected Windows Server 2000, but not Server 2003, if you look like things like Blaster, which didn't affect customers who had either patched or had firewalls up, it's a little bit overly simplistic to say this is a single monoculture. But even if you want to assume that point, then think about what are the harms we're trying to protect against. In the time that I did cybercrimes, we saw hackers attack three basic attributes in computer systems: confidentiality, integrity, and availability. It was, in fact, three early cases as far back as 1986 that, of course, got Robert Mueller so worked up about the cybercrime problem. The first being the Cuckoo's Egg in 1986. Most of you are probably familiar with it. Astronomer Berkeley Cliff Stoll lost his astronomy grant. He was put in the computer science lab to solve a small but vexing problem. Berkeley was running two accounting systems to bill computer users for their time, and there was a 75-cent billing discrepancy. As a result of that, he started studying the problem, and he realized that the problem was this. If you were an authorized Berkeley user, you were given a username and an account number. When you signed on, you entered your username and account number, and Berkeley was running two accounting programs, one to track you by username, one by account number. And at the end of the day, what happened was someone had hacked into Berkeley, created a username in the account of Hunter, and never set up a corresponding account number. When the accounting programs ran, one saw Hunter, one didn't, 75-cent discrepancy. What did Cliff do? He called the federal government. He said, someone's broken into our systems at Berkeley. We said, what's the damage? He said, so far, we're up to 75 cents. So we sent 200 agents out to Berkeley. We set up a task force. We worked around the clock. We're very dead now. We said, go away. We don't do 75-cent cases. And of course, Cliff investigated on his own and found that Hunter was a guy named Marcus Hess, one of the Hanover hackers in Hanover, Germany. And they had been paid by the KGB to steal sensitive but unclassified information off the Milnet. And so essentially, what you had as far back as 1986 is a bona fide computer espionage program by the Russians. They do not advertise that they're doing these kinds of exploits. And in fact, that wasn't an exploit of a vulnerability, but an exploit of a configuration problem that you could sign on without entering your account number. And in fact, you know, there weren't other checks in place to make sure that they were keeping bad people out. In the 80s, it was a very different environment. The point of the matter is that people attacking confidentiality of systems will not advertise the exploit that they are using, but they will use it long term. And in fact, one of the sad things about the denial of service attacks that we've been seeing is it sometimes focuses people's direction and attention solely on denial of service attacks and not confidentiality attacks, which are a big deal. The second problem is integrity attacks, and integrity attacks are also not meant to be seen. The best example I can give you is a hacker case in Seattle. We had a hacker who stole computer equipment, and as you know, we have a court system that has federal and state courts. Well, this kid stole computer equipment, and he was sentenced in state court to prison. The judge gave him a surrender date. What that means is, at the time that you are sentenced to prison, the judge can say, go in the back and start doing your 60 days, or the judge can say, okay, I'm sentencing you to prison, it's the end of June, your surrender date is the day after Labor Day, September 7th. This allows you, if you're not a risk of flight, you're not a danger to the community, this allows you to go home, you know, prepay your rent, have Labor Day picnic with your family, tell your friends you want a trip to Bermuda, you'll be gone for September and October. And then on September 7th, you show up at the prison. If you don't show up, they issue a warrant for your arrest and you get time for bail jumping. And what this kid decided to do is go home, hack into the courthouse, and commute his own sentence to probation. This is actually a great plan. The reason it's a great plan, of course, is that no one will ever detect it. The judge endorses the papers, it goes in a computer system, and at the end of the day, on September 7th, the prison gets a list of everyone who's supposed to appear. If your name's not on the list, it's not like someone's going to say, oh, wow, you know. So he decides that he wants to hack into the courthouse, but he doesn't want to dial in directly because it might be traced back to him. And so he runs a war dialer in Seattle, gets a bunch of modem tones, and he breaks into Boeing, the avionics giant, because he wants to launch his attack from a corporate platform in case the courthouse is awake and tracking this stuff. He gets into a system they use to develop software to fly planes. I fly about 200,000 miles a year, so I pay attention to this stuff. On newer planes like a Boeing 777, the plane can taxi, take off, and land all by itself. You don't need a pilot. I've talked to passengers. In a most unscientific survey, 99% want someone in the front with a hat. The airlines have that, but they actually don't need it. And sometimes when you're listening to, like, air traffic control on Channel 9 on United, you'll hear the pilot saying he's doing an automatic landing. The landing gear comes down. He goes into the restroom. You know, plane lands. Everything's fine. So the kid hacks into Boeing. Then he hacks the courthouse. He gets welcomed to district court. He breaks in. Here's the sad part of the story. He was convicted in state district court. He hacked the federal district court by mistake and got himself convicted again. But, you know, for those kinds of attacks to be successful, neither a monoculture nor a diverse culture is going to solve the problem. And, in fact, the practical matter is when people attack targeted systems, specific systems to do no good, they will look for a series of flaws, vulnerabilities, misconfigurations, unpatched systems, and other things that are equally attributable to, you know, both Windows today and Linux, assuming that you accept the fact that both systems have vulnerabilities and that system administrators sometimes make configuration errors. And so part of the problem is to say that diversity is going to solve the problem of confidentiality or integrity are just not true, and to some extent those threats can be quite severe in all sorts of ways. Boeing, for example, could not run the risk that they would have a plane crash because the individual had either deliberately or accidentally altered software. So they spent $75,000 to verify the integrity of their system. In fact, Cliff Stoll, who investigated the Cuckoo's Egg case, said to me after the fact, as bad as, you know, KGB hacking into DOD was for you, the government, you care about that stuff, the worst thing they could have done to me, Cliff Stoll, was change the value of pi in the fifth digit. As an astronomer, we were using it for every calculation, and we were never checking. The other thing, of course, about monoculture is sometimes it actually may help businesses in very functional ways, even though they accept some risk of some sort of broader failure. One of the interesting examples, of course, is Southwest Airlines, one of the few consistently profitable airlines in the United States. One of the things that they attribute their success to is their monoculture. They actually fly only one kind of plane, a Boeing 737. It does mean, of course, that if the FAA grounds the 737, they are grounded. And in fact, you may know that there have been issues about 737 rudder systems and tail systems that have been addressed by the NTSB and the FAA. On the other hand, the decision they made as a business calculus was the fact that they can put any pilot and any flight crew on any plane at any time. And therefore, the cost of managing and also in terms of maintenance, the same set of mechanics that are certified on any one plane can fix any plane. So as a practical matter, in the sense of being able to manage their infrastructure in a cost-effective way and be profitable, is benefited by a monoculture. And of course, those issues are never discussed as well. So let's talk about cascading failures, because the real gist of this is that if we had 50% Linux, we wouldn't have any cascading failures in the world, because we will have broken the monoculture. The question is that true? And I suspect it's not. You know, in the early cases that I worked back in the early 1990s, at the very earliest times when we were dealing with phone freakers who were hacking into the telephone networks, we saw the hacker groups were actually recruiting people of different skill sets so that they could attack the systems more effectively. And in fact, they would assign different people to attack different parts of the network. There were people who were experts in ELMOS, the line maintenance operating system, and COSMOS, the central office systems. And they would actually, you know, design their attacks in a way to utilize the skill sets that they had. I suspect that if we had two operating systems operating at 50%, that someone seriously interested in shutting us down could launch two things at the same time, or something that takes advantage of some commonality between the two. It's also interesting to think about the fact of whether or not having two operating systems will prevent the cascading effect, leaving aside the fact that bad guys can target two things at once. One of the interesting things, you know, that Dan talks about in his paper is the cascading effect of the SQL slammer worm. If you all recall, back in January of 2003, a SQL slammer hit. There was a broad impact on the network. Interestingly enough, statistics seem to show that it is estimated that there was 0.015% of internet machines were infected, causing 5 trillion attempted connections a day. So, assuming that such a small percentage of infected machines can create a cascade failure, is the fact that we limit an operating system to 50% of the world's computers actually provide the relief that we seek? If a very small percentage of infected machines can cause this calamity, and in fact, there was recently a reported attack on supercomputers that certain people, like Russ Cooper, say could have had broad impact had they utilized these supercomputers to attack the internet. But if you assume that such a small number of machines can cause a cascading failure, then we have to diversify the operating system, but not into two. We have to diversify it into millions. You have to get the computer proportion so small that even if some group of computers are overtaken and try to launch a sophisticated or long-term attack on the internet, they cannot generate enough traffic to have this cascading effect. So it's not really clear to me how that's going to work in practice. So in a nutshell, and I know I'm not going to use all my time, but in a nutshell, I don't think forced diversity, even if helpful, is ultimately going to solve the problem. I think part of the problem lies in what Dan says is the goal, which is, and this is a quote, the goal must be to break the monoculture. Actually, I think the goal has to be to get us more secure. The fact of the matter is that in the early 1990s, when I started doing cybercrime cases, I created the Computer Crime Unit Industry Information Group. And I created a group where the hardware, software, and telecom vendors, who were getting hacked a lot at the time, came to my office every quarter to talk about cybersecurity and help educate the government on what was coming. And what I said to these companies, some of them you may remember, Digital Equipment Corporation, Compaq, all now HP, IBM, this was even pre-AOL, so I had, you know, Bellcor, the R&D arm of the baby Bells. I had the large carriers, AT&T, MCI, and Sprint, and I had Microsoft. And what I said to the vendors were, you need to do more security. We're seeing all these cybercrime cases. What they told me was, go away. They said markets weren't interested in security, and they weren't interested in security as a result. And they said, at the end of the day, this IT revolution is about increased productivity, better quality of life, driving down the cost of doing business. It was all the good stuff, and that markets don't want security. So I started talking to markets. You can't really talk to markets, it's not a thing. But I talked to the telcos who were being hacked. I talked to the banks. You might remember a Russian named Levin hacked Citibank, moved $10 million around. I talked to the pharmaceutical companies because they were doing R&D in critical drugs, and of course some countries have bona fide economic espionage programs in place. And as I went to all these companies and said, you need to demand security of vendors and you need to do security, they told me to go away. They told me the same thing that the vendors told me, which is that this IT revolution was allowing them to streamline business process, connect with customers, reduce costs, increase profit, all the good stuff. It was the Industrial Revolution being relived. We went into the Industrial Revolution, everyone was going to have cars and refrigerators and the prices are going to be driven down, and it wasn't until years later people said, what are we going to do about things like global warming, child labor, unionization strife, all the things that came out of that revolution that was the dark side. The IT industry was no different. And so against that context, we have created an environment that is clearly not secure. We clearly have a lot to do to secure it. The question is forced diversity going to solve the problem? I don't think so. Is it actually going to maybe hurt in some ways? Arguably it could. It may not be cost effective. For companies, if complexity is the enemy of security, they get a more complex environment. They need different staffs, more trainings. If you have a monoculture, yes, you have a single point of failure, you have a single point of patch. This is what is different in some respects than human disease. People with SARS who die, we can't reboot them. So it's a different environment. We do need much greater security. The question is, how do we get there and prevent these cascading effects? I think instead of forcing the world to spend a ton of resources and efforts to do 50% Linux on the theory that a hacker can't launch two things at a time, or that this will somehow prevent a cascading effect, I don't think it's going to work. I think we would better spend our time and resources in looking at security holistically. There are times that diversification may very well be a security solution. There are also other things like isolation and resiliency, things like behavior blocking, firewalls, all those new technologies, some old like firewalls, some newer behavior blocking that are coming. It seems to me we would do a better job overall if we devoted our resources to that kind of solution and use diversity appropriately instead of just saying, you know what, let's make half the world something else and our problems will just go away.
Thank you. Okay, thank you very much. I want to thank both Dan and Scott for keeping to the time limit. I'm going to exercise my privilege as a moderator to pose the first question. I'm going to pose one question to each of them, and what we're going to do here is when you come up to the microphone, identify yourself and address one or the other candidate or whoever with with your question. That person will answer the question, and then the other one will have a chance to rebut or to respond. I'll also remind Dan and Scott to please only answer the question. You'll have a chance to refute the comments that were made in the statements when you have your closing statement. So my first question for you, Dan, is that in terms of this diversity, we have a handful, maybe five, maybe six, of legitimate operating systems in use. It doesn't seem to me like your plan for diversity is mimicking the kind of diversity you have in biological systems. So what just is the plan? What is the recommendation? What do you think we should do? And how do you account for the mutation analogy in real systems?
And I'm supposed to answer that in two sentences, right?
No. No, oh, okay. You can answer a full answer.
I'm sorry, I'm teasing the moderator, which is always a bad idea. The one thing that Scott pointed out is that in the spirit of not complaining about something unless you offer a solution, we did last September say, for example, our guess was that you shouldn't be above 50% for anyone. We didn't say you should force 50%, by the way. We said you shouldn't be above 50% for any one operating system so long as your issue was reliability and such things. At that, recent numbers from George Mason University, Sean Gorman, I doubt he's here, but if he is, he's welcome to jump in, have indicated that if the way you measure a failure is the loss of the ability of two parties to communicate, that in at any time, based on simulation here, that at any time you have, his magic number was 43% of the core infrastructure was all of one type, which is to say all vulnerable to a single attack, that the probability of two randomly selected parties being unable to communicate in the event of that attack took a sharp turn upward. In other words, there was something magic about around 43% similarity, at which point random attacks and random communication paths tended to have a sharp discontinuity upward. You'd have to look at his simulation paper about that. That's George Mason University. The idea that was advanced in the question, which is we don't have enough alternatives, you know, I won't deny that. I said, I believe at the outset, that I believe computing is, as we stand here today, at a primitive stage. We are somewhere between single-celled life and blue-green algae, so to speak, on the evolutionary scale. It is no wonder that we are having troubles. To have more diversity would be a good thing. There are attempts of this at various levels. Stephanie Forrest's group at U of New Mexico is looking at, for example, randomizing the instruction set so every machine is different than every other. That pays a cost, but one could easily argue that the price of that computing increases in power so fast that we might ought to be spending more of it on security, and paying the price of, for example, instruction set randomization on a per platform basis might be a way out. We do not have enough. Five is not enough. I do not have a plan as I sit here, but I do know that buying all of one thing is probably going in the wrong direction, even if you don't have enough of the others to buy. And at the same time, I would certainly suggest that the standards that matter, and that's for this audience in particular, the standards that matter are those that allow disparate systems to communicate with each other in a platform-independent style. And that is whether you're talking about applications and the OS they ride on, or whether you're talking about something else that's more internet-like.
Okay, thank you. I'll let you respond now.
No, this is the point I raised, that we'd need a ton of diversity to solve the problem in this way. I mean, I agree with Dan that, you know, this revolution, you know, we're in our third real revolution. We were hunters, gatherers, agrarian, industrial, and now information. And in a and we've come incredibly reliant on this technology without adequately actually training people to use it, and making sure that we could really use it in a robust way. And I will say, you know, in a sense, in a large sense, throughout the 90s, we delegated public safety and national security requirements to markets, essentially because the government ceded, to some extent, its regulatory authority under recognition that it didn't quite know how to regulate this, and regulations wouldn't even necessarily be effective. The problem with ceding public safety and national security to markets, of course, is markets are not designed to deal with that problem. And the difficulty is, as we look at a combination of markets and also perhaps regulation to deal with it, I still think we have to focus on things where we get a reasonable return on investment. And getting to the point where we have massive diversity in some of the applications and operating systems we use just doesn't seem to me to be a practical solution to today's problem.
Okay, thank you. Now I'll address the question to Scott, and Dan will have a chance to respond after Scott does. You mentioned in your statement that the problem of spam would not be solved by diversity, but it seems that many of the viruses that propagate around take advantage of similarities in the operating system. And I was wondering if you had any recommendations or any notion of what it would take on a platform to not be so vulnerable to viruses that take advantage of the similarities in the platform.
Yeah, so with the spam problem, you really have to separate out what you're talking about. Most spam is actually designed to be delivered to its end recipient and not cause a denial of service or a cascading effect. That's because the spammer wants the message delivered because the economics of spam are so favorable. The bigger problem is when you receive spam that also has an attachment that's a virus and worm. And so there are a bunch of things in both user education and technology that need to be done, and that's clearly true. I mean, for as often as we've told people not to open attachments from people that they didn't know, my doom required them to open a zip file and then click on an executable. But remember, we can't get 100% of the population to wear seatbelts, even though there's going to be pain of death and maiming. So as a practical matter, that will only get you so far. And so we do have to work on other things like better attachment blocking, making sure that executable code, you know, doesn't execute perhaps unless it's signed by someone you trust, other things that are coming in the future to give users better control over what executes.
Dan?
You know, it's interesting. I'm now going to act like the lawyer here. It seems to me that the principles that we've established, such as if I do not fence my swimming pool and your child wanders in and drowns, it is my fault, under a doctrine called attractive nuisance, I don't see how, let's take a university, let's pick on a university, let's pick on the nearest available university. If Harvard does not protect its computers and viruses wander in and then, let's say, knock CNN off the air, why is that not something for which CNN has a beef with Harvard? In other words, if you do not protect your systems, what do I care? It's a free world, it's a free market, it's a free country. You do as you like. But if your failure to protect your systems results in them being marshaled as an army to attack me, why do I not have something to say about that? And in fact, I think the idea that passing along an infection is worse than getting it is well established. Steve Rugness, who is the head of worldwide operations for Morgan Stanley, allows me to quote that in 2002, they stopped 75,000 inbound viruses, but he's prouder of the fact they stopped 150 outbound. That tells you in a decision analytics sense that his utility is 151. I think two orders of magnitude is the minimum. It ought to be three. But the idea that I don't care what you get, I just don't want it. And if you look at the way spam is transited today, that's how it gets there. The botnet rentals are like $1 a month for a botnet for spam relays. The market has already said the price of that is there's so many of them available that it doesn't that you almost have to pay nothing. That idea of being complicit, and I don't care whether it's attractive nuisance, unwitting accomplice, force majeure, or what, but the idea that there is a little liability on the part of the individual who becomes an aid and abet to the crime, regardless of their intent, has got to appear somewhere. And as long as it is blameless all around, I'm going over my time, but I'll say something. I got to hear the value at risk calculation discussion at a major New York bank. That is to say, how they figure out how much risk they should take. Cut to the chase. At the end of the day, the guy leans over the counter and says, now you may ask yourself, why does this all work? Pregnant pause. The answer is, speaking to traders, because there is zero ambiguity about which one of you owns what risk. And I'm sitting there thinking, in my world, there is 100% ambiguity about who owns what risk.
Okay. We're going to start with the front mic, alternate mics. Please address your question specifically to Dan or to Scott.
My name is Rick Barrow, representing myself, and this is a question for Scott. Scott, you mentioned that you kept saying 50% as if the world was just divided into Microsoft versus Linux. And I'd like to propose to you that, one, there's a lot of other operating systems between just Microsoft and Linux, and that Linux is not a monoculture in itself. For example, the Slapper Worm, when it was attacking variants of Linux backs several years ago, actually had 24 different offsets that it would attempt in its exploit of OpenSSL. I guess the other thing, that was just a comment on what you're saying. Really, the question is, I thought that Dan Ashley suggested another remedy in his paper that hasn't been mentioned yet, and that is that APIs be made open. If we have open APIs, then we can have a diversity of implementations, and with a diversity of implementations, it's less likely that there will be wide-scale successful attacks.
So, as you know, the antitrust decree, which I'm not going to comment on much because I was at the Justice Department when the antitrust suit was brought. So that's just the realities of it, attorney-client privilege and all that. But the antitrust decree does require the publications of APIs, and there's no question that you want that for interoperability and other things. I suspect that that won't solve the problem either, in the sense that we've got to reduce the number of vulnerabilities in code. And the 50% number actually comes from their paper. I'm happy to say and agree that there are multiple operating systems around today, but based on the slammer numbers, the number around today, even if they were evenly distributed, so you had the least group using each number conceivably, it's just not going to solve the problem.
Well, I think just one further comment, that it's not just the operating system's APIs that need to be open. That today, the single most dangerous piece of software ever written is Internet Explorer.
Right. So if you remember the time when Internet Explorer was written, there was no market demand for, nor no vendor real suppliance of security. Absolutely true. So people have said to me, you know, Microsoft should have done this 5 or 10 years ago. I said, hot frickin' flash. I was asking people to do it 10 years ago. Nobody wanted to do it. The vendors didn't want to do it. The customers didn't want it. And still, nobody wants to pay for it. And you know what? To some extent, they shouldn't. You should get secure functionality. I understand that. But in the end of the day, everyone does pay for everything,
because things take time, laborers are paid, distribution costs are put into the cost of the product. In some way, shape, or form, things are built into the cost. So people say, you know, look at anti-lock brakes and airbags, they're standard today. If you think you're not paying for those features, you're wrong. So, you know, at the end of the day, I still think that doing those things are important. And yes, there are some core things that everyone should be doing. And, you know, working on issues like Internet Explorer, clearly one of them. I grant you that.
Okay, let's give Dan a chance to follow up.
It's interesting. The experience I had largely through At Stake, where I was before, as you know, was that no matter where you are, the way to break into anybody is through their large apps. We passed the point at which fiddling with their network is the easiest way in. The easiest way in is to send, you know, some app 50,000 lowercase a's followed by SQL and triple quotes, and by God, it tells you everything you want to know, and that's far simpler than all the other mechanisms that you could think of. Apps are where the issue is as we stand here now. And in fact, in our paper, the idea we were talking about was not so much OS interfaces, but in fact the application interfaces or any interface where it would permit multiple implementations. If you believe that security faults are just a subset of quality faults and that they are unintentional, if they're intentional, we got another problem and it just isn't worth talking about. If they are unintentional, they're faults, then the question is, do you think that different parties will make the same faults? Now, there's some discussion about that where, for example, very complex specifications do generate the same faults, but the complexity there is the enemy, although it happens to be in the specification. I sort of picked on ASN1 compilers before and will continue to do so as long as I can stand. But the idea is clear that it is simple interfaces, well documented, that is a principal avenue to changing what is in place in the field if you believe that security faults are unintentional.
Okay, yes. Second microphone.
Hi, my name is Perry Metzger, and I guess I have to identify myself because this is being recorded, et cetera, and I'm one of the co-authors of Dan's paper. I'm addressing the question to Scott principally. Okay. You almost exclusively focused in discussing your experiences as a prosecutor on what we were not addressing at all in our paper. You were talking about individual break-ins done targeted by particular people. And what we were talking about almost exclusively was the sorts of massive worm infestations that occur. I think that we're all well aware of the fact that diversity will not fix all security problems, and if a particular machine is being targeted, then the diversity is not the question. The question is that particular machine vulnerable? But you did not, you know, you were mostly addressing something that we weren't talking about at all, and in fact, as a practical matter, my customers, I do security for a living, who have a diversity of servers, find that when these worm infestations hit, they're in better shape. This is just as a practical, everyday matter. I mean, this is an observable fact. The ones that have, you know, great, you know, fleets.
Perry, we need a question.
Yeah, the question is, you've stated basically that where's the beef? You know, how do we know that this works? And we see it working in practice. Are you really going to assert that if I have all Windows machines that I'm going to be safe against a worm infestation that hits Windows machines, that I'm not going to be better off having a variety of machines so they all don't get taken out at once?
Right. The difficulty with that argument is to suggest that the only business consideration is security. So I also deal with a lot of customers. Some of them have been attacked by worms, and you say, what platform are you running? And they say, NT4. And you say, well, that's interesting, because had you been running Windows Server 2003, you wouldn't have been impacted, either because you actually didn't need a patch, because the default settings were locked down by default, whatever the case may be. So it's absolutely true, if you have vulnerable machines, then if you have different OSs, for example, some machines will be vulnerable and some not. But the customers I talk to say it's just not that black and white in how they make their purchasing decisions and how they decide to manage their architectures and infrastructures, in part because they have to then manage two sets of patches, two sets of bulletins, two sets of trained people, and all of that. And so there's some trade-offs, and at the end of the day, you know, it goes back to Southwest Airlines. There are some trade-offs, and the decision is not based solely on security, but a combination of factors. So to say to a company, look, for the security portion, you should move you know, some percentage of your machines to these different OSs, because you will get more resiliency in your network, actually requires a lot of consideration. If the front end is down, it may be great that your databases are up, but your clients can't get to them because they've been infected. Your clients may be up, but your back end's infected, so your people are sitting at their terminals, but they can't access the Exchange server or the mail server or the database, whatever the case may be. And so they really have to plan this very carefully and figure out where diversity will actually get you a gain that is meaningful in your business environment. And as I said at the very outset, diversity is certainly a factor and should be considered as part of an overall business plan. But the suggestion that diversity in and of itself is the goal, and that's what the paper said.
No, it did not.
The goal is to break the monoculture. That's a quote.
Yeah, no, I do want to be specific here. We did not say that diversity was a panacea. We said that there were specific classes of extremely important problems that it fixed. But I don't think that anyone who was involved in writing the paper claimed that it was a panacea, that it would fix all security problems, that it was the only consideration to be made. It was just that there are certain classes of problems that it helps.
And I agree with that. The problem is it doesn't help it enough. If you look at SQL Slammer, for example, it's not clear that it helps it enough.
It didn't hit any of my Oracle servers.
Perry, the debate is with Dan. So what I'd like to do is keep the format to ask a question and then give the two people up here a chance to answer them in turn. So
I almost feel like I should say I'm happy to yield a minute of my time to the senator from Kentucky. one thing I would like to, and this isn't really fair to Scott because he's not supposed to reply, but one must remember that on a worldwide basis, the percentage of Windows platforms that are, frankly, pirated is high. And a decision for him that I don't know how either him or his management team or whatever make is deciding between what kind of patching or service pack availability you make to people who are clearly already thieves in the ordinary sense, when, in fact, just as he said earlier, it takes a very small percentage of infected machines to cause trouble for everybody. And we see that no matter where we look. We see that no matter where we look. The one thing I guess I would say is that it is quite possible, I will say as a matter of principle, it's quite possible to harden an environment, but to do so in a way that inadvertently creates brittleness as opposed to toughness. Those of you who are metallurgists will know exactly what I mean. It is quite easy to make something hard that is brittle, not tough. I would submit that Southwest Airlines is probably very hard, but at the same time, brittle, just as he said. A grounding incident around 737s, and they are simply not working. Now, that is a bet they are making, the same way that every motorcycle rider in Rhode Island or New Hampshire wears no helmet. But it's not a bet that I think is good public policy, and more to the point, what Perry and I and others were writing in our piece was, absent leadership, what can individual enterprises do? That was the point about breaking it. You have to break it for yourself because it ain't going to happen any other way.
Okay, let's.
Can I just say one thing? I agree with that completely. My point is that, yes, it is a question of what enterprises can do. And budgets are always limited. People are always limited. So if enterprises are considering what they're going to do, they need to consider the benefits of diversity, sure. They also need to consider, do I get a better return on investment by building other kinds of security and putting other kinds of security in place, getting a documented information security program in place, getting good auditing practices in place, getting better user education in place, all those things. There's only one pie. And so I still come back to you have to figure out where's your best return on investment.
Just to keep it fair, do you want a quick response to that, or should we move on to the next question?
It's like catastrophe insurance. You know what? It's like, for those of you who live in California, buying earthquake insurance is essential and impossible. And in the same sense, at some point you have to say, it would be a good thing that we didn't all live in California. And I don't mean to insult anyone from there, but it would be a good thing that we didn't.
Okay, next question.
Okay, Prezzato, Google. This is actually directed to the Reverend Dan. the analogies, unfortunately, are always brittle themselves. Trying to look at sort of a biological diversity and trying to compare what computers do to biological diversity, I'll even grant you that we could have greater diversity than two. And in fact, I mean, bacteria divide somewhere between 1 in 1 million and 1 in 1 billion, depending on cell divisions. They're mutate rather about once every billion or once every million, depending on the flavor of bacteria you're working with. We've got like 10 million different white cells floating, or different flavors of white cells with their own antigens floating around in our bodies. I'll even assume that at some point you have that many different kinds of operating systems. Even then, I don't even think the analogy is apt, because the thing we're talking about, sort of the national infrastructure, the corporate infrastructures, things like that, the computers themselves aren't independent cells like bacteria are. If you the computers aren't this thing that's floating in a sea of DNA, where if one of them survives, all of the rest of them somehow slowly become immune to the attack or can take on the functions that the dead ones do. Whenever we've seen attacks inside of Lucent that have affected, say, only Internet Explorer, sort of the lead ethyl version of software, we end up with all of our systems, all of our routers, all of our everything being broken. All of our Unix systems going down because the Microsoft systems are pounding on them. All of our routers going down because the bandwidth has gone away. So the diversity is not helping us, even though we had fairly large diversity. We were running, half dozen operating systems. We were running lots of different routers. But the thing is, since it's not a bunch of separate organisms, it was only one large organism that was being hit. Doesn't matter if, only our heart is affected by the bacteria that's invaded us and our heart is destroyed, but the rest of us is okay. How do you answer that?
Let me make sure I'm getting one thing right there. You agree, I assume, that our state of computing is primitive by what one must imagine the future will hold.
Yeah, I don't even think we've gotten up to the bacterial level yet.
Okay, exactly. And so if you were looking at the historical record, you would be saying the same thing here. By God, you need more than two kinds of algae, right? And in fact, the snowball hypothesis for Earth implies that, in effect, and I'm sure you've read about that. The thing that I guess I would say is you're absolutely right that a small percentage of loss can be a large effect. There are papers in the physics journals, even physics review letters, that talk about so-called scale-free networks, which, much like a fractal image, no matter how far back you are, it still looks the same. It has the same general structure. And those tell you that there are some machines that are more important than others. And in fact, if you were organizing the most intelligent patching, you would probably go after that. There's a counter paper in Science from, in fact, where is he now? I don't know where he is now, but he was one of Stephanie Forrest's students, in which he said that, in fact, that's not necessarily the case, because one might have several networks that one is a part of. An email network, the sum of all the entries in your address book, the sum of all the messages you received, a list of all the hosts that you have connected to over the last 6 months, that kind of thing. Those are all separate networks. And you might have an important role in one, but not an important role in the other. And their conclusion in that paper in Science was that when an infection occurs, the most important thing is for the environment around it to contain the infection, which is exactly what an immune system does. The first job of an immune system is to contain it. Their suggestion, by the way, is absolute network bandwidth throttling.
I shouldn't debate, but that isn't the function of an immune system. In fact, the result of an immune system is usually contagion.
Dave, I want to let Scott come out with the counterpoints.
Sorry, it was just too blatant.
We can go to the next question.
Well, okay. Actually, I'm quoting a bacteriologist who runs the Bacteriology Museum on the Internet, so we can have that debate offline.
Okay, let's go to Dan. Scott has yielded his time.
Since I
yield. Right here.
Fine. Dan Klein, I mean.
Oh. Yeah, Dan Klein. I'm a GDI, an independent. Since I predominantly agree with what Mr. Geer has said, in spite of the fact that Marcus Ranum is standing behind me, I'll address my question. I'll address my question to Mr. Charney. I believe that you're correct when you say that security is about trade-offs. I further believe that you're correct when you say that a lot of absence of security is due to configuration, human nature, the tenacity of hackers. And I agree with you that forced heterogeneity is not the way to go, but I would argue that informed heterogeneity is the way to go. The problem is, when you talk about management and customers saying go away when it comes to security, you're not talking about the people in this room. We're the ones who want the security. We're the ones who suffer as a result of the lack of security. And when I look at the media, I see that everybody blames the hackers. They don't blame the underlying operating system, which is rife with flaws, regardless of what that operating system may be. So with a monoculture, which is instilled with flaws, be it in configuration or in underlying structure or just gaping holes because nobody thought of something, and a user culture which is imbued with the misconception that somebody's going to fix it and it'll all go away, I believe it's all too late. So how do you address the question that the underlying fabric that we're dealing with is so pervasive and so flawed that there may not be a fix?
So first of all, I am one of those people who also suffer from computer security breaches. I've spent much of my, you know, career working on the problem. And also, I would not, although I certainly believe that hackers should be held accountable, I have never said, I have never said a hacker is accountable for the vulnerability in a product. I think vendors have to stand up and own that responsibility and work hard to reduce the number of vulnerabilities. I mean, if you look at, for example, what we've started doing, we now delay shipment of products in the name of security. That was not traditionally done. If you look at the number of, you know, critical and important vulnerabilities in Windows 2000 and 2003 in their first year of life, the numbers have dropped from 42 to 14. Still way too high, but the security push that was done on Windows Server 2003 happened after it was coded, and the time to do security is at design time. And so, you know, to some extent, I can understand the frustration of saying, maybe we've dug such a deep hole that we can't get out. But I don't know what the answer to that is. I mean, you know, when people have floated the idea, let's all start over. You know, Dick Clark, who was the chair of the President's Critical Infrastructure Protection Board, said we should revisit all the protocols. Let's start over. These things were built 20, 25 years ago. I mean, as a practical problem, the biggest thing we face, and we see it still, is that people need backward compatibility. They've invested a ton of this infrastructure, and they can't even start over. I mean, our large enterprise customers say to us, you know, we own Windows Server 2003. We have an enterprise agreement with you, but we can't deploy it. And the reason we can't deploy it is not the difficulty of loading 2003 on a box. It's that we have all these applications that were written on older platforms. And the truth of the matter is they were written when every process in the operating system read with system administrator privilege. And now that you're actually enforcing the doctrine of least privilege, which has been around for 25 years, but you never paid attention to it before, and most of the community didn't either, as the end result of that, we can't port these applications forward. So if we've dug ourselves in such a deep hole that we have to start over, I don't know how we do that.
Dan?
There's no doubt that the entire market for security right now, all the customers spend is driven by compliance, which is to say the number of things to comply with is getting out of hand, but that is a reaction on the part of legislative and other entities in government. And that everything you can think of about compliance, I mean, you look at Sarbanes-Oxley, when you finally read the fine print, everything it talks about ends up being something that's implemented in IT and uses what you and I would refer to as security technology. It's compliance that's driving that. I don't think the customer community, other than this one, is going to demand security. I'm actually unhappy with that, but I believe it's realpolitik, that it doesn't ask for it and it wouldn't get it automatically. That compliance is the only answer. The question, of course, is when compliance is proposed, what is the position of industry? And if there's anything that took the teeth out of Richard Clark's first draft of a National Infrastructure Protection Plan, it was the lobbying of the members of the Information Technology Association of America, hands down.
I would just like to comment very quickly that Microsoft publicly went on record that our complaint with the national strategy was that it didn't have enough teeth and didn't go far enough. And I continue to believe that if we're going to have meaningful progress, we need to address this on many fronts, including having some things with teeth. But I also disagree a little bit in that customers don't want security but for compliance.
And the but your point about spend. Spend is driven by compliance.
I'm not sure that's quite true anymore, in the sense that in the customers I talk to, I see a shift that begins with their perceptions about security. You know, 3 years, 5 years ago, I'd say, how do you think about security? And they'd say, I think about what I have to lock down. And now they say, I'm locking down everything. I think about what I have to open up to be productive. And I think that reflects some change. And I'm not saying that people are running out to spend money, big bucks, on security. When I was at PricewaterhouseCoopers, other consultants told me, you know, go in there and sell security as a business enabler. I said, I can't do it. I don't even believe it. Security is not a business enabler. It's a cost center. You wouldn't do security if there weren't bad guys. We wouldn't have metal detectors at airports if there weren't people trying to blow up planes or hijack them. So it's a necessary cost, and I think companies' willingness to accept that is changing somewhat.
Yes, there's no doubt that in most situations, laws about what you may not do are primarily, in their day-to-day effect, a limit on people who are good. There's no doubt about that.
Okay.
And it's a sad fact.
We now have about 3 minutes left until the closing statements to allow time. Let's try to get some questions in quickly with some quick answers, and we'll get as many as we can, hopefully the rest of them.
Martin Krzywinski, Genome Sciences Center. For Scott, comment and a question. I think the Southwest airline, from my perspective, isn't a monoculture. It's a monoculture in the context of a multiculture. It's monoculture by choice. The airline bought 737s. They could have gone with another choice. I think monoculture is the absence of choice. And I think looking from the perspective of a user of a product, be it software or hardware, lack of choice engenders complacency. And when I'm complacent, I'm more susceptible to the forces of marketing. So now, how does a vendor of a product who has in front of them an audience which is hanging on their every word instill intelligent choices in a monoculture where there are no choices? I think that's the main point, is that if there's no choices, your customers won't be asking questions, and therefore you won't be motivated to create intelligent solutions.
Right. I think choice is a good thing. I'm a fan of choice. I mean, to some extent, you know, the issue of did you have choice in the operating system goes back to the antitrust issues, and I cannot discuss them.
Real quick, Dan.
The point of choice is in a world where you want everything to work together. That is to say, where you want your applications to be federated, you want to have things work across corporate boundaries, national boundaries, you name it. The purpose of that is, in fact, the very point I was harping on before, which is the choice has to be such that defined interfaces are simple, stable, and they work.
Okay, one question in the back, and I think we have about a minute left, so this is going to have to be the last question before the summing up. Sorry.
Marcus Granum, True Secure, the guy who festoons his computer. My question is for Dr. Geer, and I'm in a strange situation because I'm also a confirmed Microsoft basher, and standing at Usenix, I run the risk of preaching to the choir, as do you. Could you comment, please, on your targeting algorithm by which you and your peers chose to attack Microsoft specifically as a monoculture in view of the fact that in the computing environment, we have other monocultures, such as the Intel instruction set monoculture, the browser monoculture, in which we're down to pretty much two browsers, AOL, which is a monoculture of one, and web servers, which is a monoculture of two. Don't you think you run the risk of looking like you've just done another anti-Microsoft whine?
Not at all.
Scott, do you have...
Now, that could be my answer, but I guess what I would say is not at all. The question is, open any web page of CERT statistics, for example. Open any place where records are being kept. Look at where the vulnerabilities, look at where the incidents, look at where the impact, look at where, in fact, the ratio of skill to power changes fast. Look at what is happening. We are driven by data, and I will never make an apology for that.
Scott, no, okay, so at this point, I will let Scott give his concluding remarks.
I'll be very brief. I actually want to thank the audience. You know, when I was given the task of cyber crimes, I was invited to and appeared at an early edition of the Computer Freedoms and Privacy Conference to debate with the EFF on the Justice Department's response to cybercrime. And many of the hackers stood in the back and gave me the finger. I'm happy to say this is a much more polite audience. But my point really remains the same, which is that we have dug ourselves in a hole. We need to dig ourselves out of the hole. And I think the way to do that is think holistically about security. And the monoculture may not be the big problem that is presented, in the sense that having greater diversity in the operating system will not necessarily solve our problem. Even with, you know, a fairly ubiquitous product, there are reasonable steps that people can take to get more secure, and we need to take those steps. Dan did say on several occasions that we are in a very primitive state, and I agree with that, and that, you know, the way he looked at this timeline of amoeba to, you know, cell to amoeba and forward, it sounds like the more comprehensive solution he seeks is 50 to 100 years off. I will be dead by then. I need to deal with the problems that we face today. And I just don't think that the diversity in forcing or diversity in a monoculture is going to solve the problem. I still think, too, and Dan used the term realpolitik, I agree with him. I mean, it's fine to think of things as great in a conceptual way, but they have to be actionable to make meaningful progress. And I'm cognizant of the fact that for many enterprises, they need to be actionable today, not wait for the technology to be far less primitive than it is today. And I think there are other solutions that still may get us a more secure environment than just saying we need to break up the monoculture.
Well, in our original plan, we were to have 10 minutes of talks, and of course I wrote one, but in the spirit of trying to be fair, I will shorten it substantially, though I will eventually post all of this. Let me just say a few paragraphs from what I said, was to have said. In my remarks today, I've endeavored to share with reasonable men and women that nature has without question shown us that monoculture is at best a primitive state, or at worst, a dying gasp. We have seen that the few truly infrastructural components of life are the common property of all life and are defended with unmatched vigor by all life. We have palpated the implications of submitting ourselves to nature's lessons, which I enumerated earlier. We have realized just how tired the public is of finding itself in the position of the Red Queen, where it does take all the running you can do to keep in the same place. We have understood that our computing monoculture encourages a high flux of amateur attackers, and though this flux is itself a substantial drag on society, that flux of amateur attacks inevitably obscures the actions of professionals of whom we should be mortally afraid. We have come to understand that more diversity in our computing base would raise the skill level required to be an attacker, thus depressing the numbers of them. Perhaps the pinnacle of our realizations, we have understood that we have the most to lose because we are the most interdependent. We have reluctantly concluded that unknown vulnerabilities are likely to be with us forever, and that they are surely in the hands of the professionals, professionals who are no doubt grateful for the scope of applicability for those vulnerabilities that a monoculture provides. We have even seen that virus writers try to deliver monocultures as their work product. We have remembered history and considered other brushes with monoculture, all of them coming at the hand of man. And in so remembering history, we have the opportunity to not repeat it. We have met the enemy, and he is us.
Before we move ahead to the straw poll, I think we should offer a warm thank you to the two panelists here for coming and talking to us and engaging us this way. I want you to think back now to the opening statements, and again, let's see the show of hands for this side and this side. Okay, well, it was fun. Thank you very much.